Everyone, please be seated. We'll be starting in just a moment. The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will now come to order. Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Flaken.
Here.
Vice Chair Fernandez-Barkin. Representatives Barnaby, excused. Beltran.
Here.
Benjamin.
Here.
Byrd.
Here.
Caruso.
Here.
Davis.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Gregory.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Learned.
Here.
Rayner. Smith.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosa. We have a quorum, so welcome everyone to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. I'd ask anyone speaking before the committee to please fill out an appearance form and, as usual, make sure any electronic devices are on silent or off. So to get started, good morning, everybody. We'll hear from our judicial system agencies about their respective budget priorities for this coming fiscal year. I would anticipate we'll hear the remainder of the agency budget request at a future meeting. As we finish up these presentations, I want to encourage questions from the committee members before the, as the presenters come up. In an effort to hear all presenters before us today, I would like to remind members that we have only an hour and a half to complete today's agenda. So please, let's extra focus on keeping our questions concise and hold all questions until the presenter is finished. Also, advise anyone, because time is short, do any follow-up with the presenters outside the subcommittee room. I'm sure any of them would be very helpful. And, of course, staff can be helpful after as well with any questions that still need an answer after today. So we have several presenters today representing our state court system, which include Judge Clay Roberts from the First District Court of Appeal, Judge Mark Mahan for the Fourth Judicial Circuit, and Katie Cunningham, Deputy State Courts Administrator. We'll go ahead and get started with Ms. Cunningham. Welcome, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's really nice to see everybody in person again. My name is Katie Cunningham. Some of you actually may know me from the House from way back when, or more recently from the governor's office. But about a year ago, I moved over to the state courts, and I'm currently serving as the Deputy State Courts Administrator, and I'm exceptionally proud to be representing the third branch of government. I'm here today to present the judicial branch's legislative budget request. And with me are Chief Judge Mark Mahan from the Fourth Judicial Circuit and Judge Clay Roberts with the First District Court of Appeal. But before I get started, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to introduce Allie Sackett. She is our new State Courts Administrator. As many of you know, Lisa Keel, who has been the longtime State Courts Administrator, she recently retired, and Ms. Sackett has been appointed to replace her. She comes to us from the Florida Bar, where she worked for over 14 years. She was most recently the director of their legal division. And prior to that, she worked at Legal Services of North Florida, where she practiced in the areas of civil, family, and juvenile law. So we are exceptionally happy to have her and particularly glad with her experience and her knowledge of the court system that she's going to be a great asset for OSCA. So as I said, I'm here today to present the branch's legislative budget request. This year's request totals a little over $51 million, which equates to about a 6% increase to our base recurring budget. And Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'll start by providing an overview of the Supreme Court issues, and then I'm going to turn it over to Judge Roberts to talk about our one appellate court issue. He'll turn it over to Judge Mahan to talk about our trial court issues, and then you get to see me again, if that's all right. I'll follow up with our OSCA issues and some of our branch-wide issues. So first up are the Supreme Court issues. This year, there's only one, and it requests funding to implement a Supreme Court Fellows Program. The court currently has an intern program, but it's somewhat limited in that it only lasts for one semester, and it is not a paid internship. Interns do receive class credit for their work, But because it's unpaid, it really limits the applicant pool to folks that can essentially afford to volunteer for a semester. I can speak personally here for a minute and say that even if my law school grades had been good enough to apply for such an internship, which let's be very clear, they were not, I would not have been able to do it because I could not have afforded it, frankly. So what we did is we looked at the gubernatorial fellows program. We also looked at the House actually has a legislative fellows program, a very robust one. And so we modeled what we are requesting after those programs. So this funding will allow us to expand the program to 2 semesters, which will give the fellows a lot more experience and really allow them to work on more complex issues for the justices. And it will also be paid, which again will really expand that applicant pool to folks who would otherwise not be able to apply. And just like the legislative fellows program, it would pay for up to 18 hours of in-state tuition and give students credit for that. So the justices are really excited about this. We hope we can get the funding to implement it. And like I said, this is our only Supreme Court issue, so I'm going to turn it over to Judge Roberts to talk about our appellate court issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm Clay Roberts. I'm a judge on the First District Court of Appeal. I'm here in my role as chairman of the District Court Budget Commission. The appellate courts have one issue this year, and it's a continuation of an issue you funded last year. Last year, you gave us $4.7 million to do phase one of this. And what this project is an appellate court case management solution. It's the computer system by which we take in the cases, reroute the briefs and the record to all the judges vote, and send it down to the clerk's office so it may be distributed to the public. We have a system that's been in place for parts of it close to 30 years. It's based on some old database technology. It's getting hard to maintain, and it's really time to change it. We can't get updates for a lot of this stuff anymore. So what we asked for last year and what we're asking for the continuation this year is for us to purchase a commercial off-the-shelf program. And we've surveyed all the other states, and we found the industry leader in this area that has a good program that most states use that are very happy with it. That's Thomson Reuters. We signed a contract with them in August. All the preliminary work's being done. We're doing the data migration plan. We're doing the cloud storage plan. Everything is happening on time and on budget, and we're very pleased by how things are going. So what we're asking for this year is $4.5 million to finish out this project. Are there any questions?
We're going to wait till questions till the after Judge Mahan.
Okay, absolutely. I will be prepared to come back up. Together. And so I would like to introduce Chief Judge Mark Mahan from the Fourth Circuit.
Good morning. It's, as Katie said, it's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I'm here on behalf of the trial courts, not the appellate courts, not the Supremes, but the actual the trial judges. So we have 3 issues primarily, and the first is the pandemic recovery plan, which is year 2. These are all non-recurring monies. We have additional workload that was generated by the pandemic in different forms, and that's cases that were delayed and being filed, additional cases because of speedy trial and some of the criminal things that were slowed down, additional civil cases where there was unavailability for witnesses. They couldn't travel. They couldn't see some of the clients. They couldn't do sometimes a medical exam. So some of those cases have been delayed. We've got foreclosures that might be out there and evictions. And so we have an additional, as I like to say, there's a mouse that's working its way through the snake. We hope that once we get through this additional workload, we'll be back to normal, but it will take some time. And we don't suggest that those resources be put in place permanently with FTEs, but that we use some OPS, general magistrates, program specialists, some staff attorneys. We've asked for some senior judge days and for some mediation, and that's $10 million, which is year 2 of this ask. We also have asked for some post-pandemic technology support is our second ask. That's $10 million, $3 million non-recurring, and the remainder is recurring. We've discovered that while the courts were not very good technologically prior to this time, frankly, they did a lot. Most of our proceedings were done in person and live. The world has kind of changed, and we had to kind of catch up with that. And that means we had to go in and learn technology and then have IT to support that and get the resources necessary. And IT is such a big part of what we find we need. And so that's those resources that we're seeking in the technology support and finally courthouse furnishings. The statutes say that the private areas of courthouses are the responsibility of the legislature and the state. The public areas are responsibility of the counties. So these are some, and you can see on that they're the 2nd, 5th, 8th, 9th, and 14th circuits have asked for some furniture, and the 11th circuit has a request for furniture. This is all non-recurring, as it is furniture refresh or replacement. And so those are the asks from the trial courts. And I'll be ready for questions if Mr. Chairman wants to call me back up or any further information. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for members? Oh, you're going to complete? Okay.
I've got a couple more. thanks, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to briefly go over the OSCA issues, and then I'll sort of highlight two of the statewide issues that we have. So the Office of the State Courts Administrator is what we refer to as OSCA. We are the administrative arm of the branch. So what that means, we basically handle all of the administrative functions for the state court system, all the trial courts, all of the appellate courts. As you might imagine, that's a lot. This is budget, it's finance and accounting, it's procurement, it's HR. It's also some of the more substantive areas, like court services, court improvement, all of the judicial training. We handle that as well. So this year, OSCA has two LBR issues. The first requests funding and two FTE that will allow us to better support court operations. So one of these FTE is requested for our general services unit. This is the unit that basically primarily handles procurement, emergency management, things like that. And this FTE will allow us to dedicate an employee specifically to grant management. Right now, we've got one employee that's responsible for both contracts and grant management. But with the increase in both the number and the value of our contracts and grants over the past decade, we really do need an employee dedicated to each of these areas. And then the other FTE is for our resource planning unit. This unit has a multitude of functions, and I won't go into detail about all the ones that they do. But they are primarily responsible for developing and maintaining our funding methodologies. They staff our trial court budget commission, which in and of itself is quite the task. And they also develop our forecasts for future revenues. Right now, this office has three staff. That's it, just three. And they really do need help, particularly now. As you know, the pandemic has greatly changed trial court operations. And the current methodologies that we use to determine resource needs are really requiring a lot more analysis, particularly regarding how technology is changing the resources that we need. So we're hoping we can get that office a little bit of help. The last OSCA issue requests funding and one FTE to support our problem-solving courts. We've got a position right now that assists our adult drug courts with implementing our best practice standards. This position is currently grant-funded. But the grant funding will be expiring in December of 2022. And then we're also hoping to get some funding to convert an OPS position into an FTE. So this position is responsible for data collection, auditing, and analysis of drug court and specialty court participant data. And given the more permanent nature of these duties, these are statutory requirements that OSCA has to fulfill. We think it's better suited for a full-time position. And we're also hoping it'll help us retain a person in that position for more than a few months, because that's a problem we've been having. And so the last issue, the last couple issues I'll talk about are what I kind of call our more branch-wide issues. The first relates to judicial pay. And while I recognize pay issues are often handled addressed normally at the full appropriations level, I did want to highlight it for this subcommittee. As you're aware, the legislature has been exceptionally generous over the past few years in providing salary increases, not just to our Supreme Court justices, but just last year to our District Court of Appeal judges. This year, we are requesting funds to provide a 10% increase to our trial court judges. This funding will not only increase our circuit judge national ranking, which right now we're ranked 26th in the country, and this would increase that to 15. But more importantly, definitely more importantly, it will really help the branch recruit and retain quality judges. And then the second branch-wide issue involves the certification of need for additional judges. This year's opinion has not been released yet. We expect to see that in the next month or two. So there's not a lot of detail I can give about what additional judges are needed throughout the state. But I do know it's something that the subcommittee will see, you know, going forward. It might be something we amend our LBR to address going forward. So, Mr. Chair, I've provided a lot of information in a very short amount of time. I'm happy to sit down with anybody to go over things in more detail. And just thanks for the opportunity to present. And I look forward to working with you and your incredible staff over the coming months to develop our budget. And I'm happy I can answer any questions.
Well, great. Representative Fabricio, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much for coming and for a wonderful and concise and cogent presentation. I appreciate it. With regard to the Supreme Court fellows, mm-hmm. You may have mentioned it, I may have missed it. How many fellow slots are going to be created?
I think right now, let me see if I can tell what we kind of have now. 10. What we're looking at is funding for 10 fellows, OPS fellows.
All right, very good. Thank you so much.
You bet.
You recognize Representative Benjamin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the same lines as the fellowship, how much are we talking about paying the fellows and talk about the number amount that we're talking about paying the fellows? And what should diversity be like up to this point?
You recognize?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think what we calculated for the LBR ask was $13 an hour, which is what the Legislative Fellows Program pays. We're trying to mirror you guys have a really, really, really good fellows program. So we really tried to mirror that. And unfortunately, we probably might be competing with some of the same folks if we get funding. But I believe it's $13 an hour, and then it's up to 18 hours of in-state tuition credit. And Representative, I don't know the diversity. My anticipation is that by making the fellowship paid, we're really opening up in a way it's never been opened up before to people like myself who could not have afforded it. I think just expanding the applicant pool is a good thing. But I can get you additional information about kind of the history of the interns thus far and what that looks like demographically. You bet.
Representative Beltran, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. I want to go back to judicial pay for a second. If you could maybe give the committee the pay county, circuit, DCA, and Supreme, and then tell us this 10% bump is going to be from what to what, and then you said that it would take us from 26th to 15th. I'm wondering if that is in absolute terms or purchasing power or cost of living terms, if that's been weighted for purpose of the ranking of us in the states, please. Thank you.
You recognize?
Mr. Chair. So Supreme Court justices currently make $227,218. DCA judges, like I said last year, they just got a 10% increase. They make $192,105. Your circuit court judges, there's 606 of them right now. They currently make $165,509. That increase would then take them, it's a 10% increase, it would take them to $182,060. County court judges, we have 334 of them. They currently make $156,377. And a 10% increase would take them to $172,015. And you asked about the ranking. So the National Center for State Courts every year issues a very, very fancy survey of judicial salaries. And they look at every state, circuit, county, appellate, Supreme Court justice. So this is the data that we use to look at where our rankings stand. Right now, our with the increases given to the justices and the District Court of Appeal judges, those two categories are in the top 10% nationally. But our trial courts, like I said, we're about mid-range right now at 26. So this will take us to 15.
You recognize?
Thank you, Chairman, and I thank you very much for that information. I did have a question for Judge Roberts. Is this the right time for that? Please. Thank you for your answer.
Good. Yes, sir.
Good to see you, Judge.
Yes, sir. Good to see you.
For your presentation. You mentioned the appellate case management system, and I just wanted to get a little bit more detail on that because I guess as a practicing lawyer, I've had problems. It's hard to get the brief. Sometimes only the parties can get the brief. So if you're new to a case or you're just looking at it as a member of the public, sometimes the legislature takes an interest in cases, it's hard to access on the current system. What I want to know is this new system that you're proposing, is that going to make it, you know, so that kind of what I expect from a public court docket that I can pull all the documents unless they're really sealed, and they're sealed for some proprietary or personal confidential information.
Yes, sir. Right now, the briefs are available to just the parties online, so you have to be a registered lawyer in the case. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is a bandwidth issue. The number of briefs that we have is enormous. The more important issue is a lot of times the lawyers don't do a very good job in making sure that confidential information that's not supposed to be out to the public is redacted from those briefs before they file them to us. So that's why we have that limitation. I think the system will do more on the bandwidth issue, and we are trying to work with counsel to make sure we have less and less of that confidential information we can't release in the briefs, but that's a concern going forward, and we certainly will want to work to make it easier for the lawyers that practice before us, or certainly a lawyer that's joining a case anew, to get access to the documents he or she needs.
Thank you, Judge. I really hope you guys can work, because I'm very concerned as a member of public. It's really that it really needs to be a little more user-friendly. It sounds like you guys are working on that.
Yes, sir. I will have the committee that's working with us reach out to you to so they can know your specific concerns when they're putting in the design requirements. All right, thank you.
Next up, we'll have Ranking Member Gottlieb, followed by Representative Rayner, and I'd like to get this segment wrapped up in the next 3 minutes or so. So let's please make the questions concise, because we've got a lot of different agencies today to cover. And of course, you all be available after the meeting with any follow-up that we can answer. So you're recognized, Ranking Member Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try to be real brief. I love what Judge Roberts is doing, and I love the fact that we picked a program off the shelf in order to save money for making greater efficiency in the appellate court system. My question for Asuka is there any plan to do that? Because I practice throughout the state, especially since COVID, and there's from county to county, it's different. So for instance, yesterday I was in Palm Beach, I got a disposition the minute I was done in court. In Broward, unfortunately, I have to wait sometimes days for that to come online. Is there anything that we're gonna do as a state, especially in light of our data transparency, to standardize from county to county what's happening at the trial level?
You recognize?
Sure. I think what I can say, there's nothing in our LBR that addresses that.
Understood.
This year. I do know that we are actively, we have a trial court technology commission, a Florida Court Technology Commission, that looks in that. We're looking at sort of our case management systems right now. But you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly between the clerks and between our systems, there are a variety of systems out there that, unfortunately, the public and attorneys have to navigate to get the information they need. It is something we're looking at. We're actually also, just Tuesday, we met with FD Lee. You mentioned data transparency. The Uniform Arrest Affidavit, which was recently, they just presented that in House Judiciary. We're working with them, and as are the clerks, to see what's the next phase of that, and how can we get, again, a standard information, you know, to the clerks from booking agencies and then to us. So we're looking at it, and not just the UAA, but a multitude, again, our case management systems and trying to better streamline those. So maybe. I don't know when that might turn into an LBR request, but it is certainly something we're looking at.
Understood. Thank you. Next, Chair.
Thanks. Representative Rayner, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your presentation. This is my question specifically is regarding the trial courts, the pandemic. Yes, Chief Judge. Yes, Your Honor, I see you. The pandemic recovery plan. I know that we are still facing a lot. Even my home county that I practice in, Pinellas, it is up and down. I just got an order now telling us new protocols. So what, and you may have addressed this, but what kind of things are you expecting this $10 million to cover as we're talking about the pandemic recovery plan?
Well, through the chair, right now we feel like we need some magistrates, some program specialists, some mediators, some of the support staff to try to look at those cases, case manage those, and move those along, and also senior judges. Again, the problem with putting a number of judges in place that are permanently added is, you know, we hope once we get through this we don't want to be overjudged in that circumstance, and be mindful of your responsibility with regard to the taxpayers' money. So we're hoping that senior judges will help. We're struggling a little bit, as everyone is, with hiring people. You know, it's we run into problems with with vacancies as every, you know, restaurants and supply chains and everyone. And so we're struggling a little bit about with that. We received some one-time pandemic relief money last year, and we're working on trying to get that out. And sometimes you have more problems in hiring OPS than permanent positions, because of course people want some permanency when they take those jobs. But we're doing the best we can. And of course, two other things I would remind you, it's such a different part. What happens in Miami doesn't necessarily happen in Liberty County or in Duval or wherever. And so some of that is out there. And plus, the rules seem to be rewritten all the time. And, you know, what you think is happening now, you look 6 months down the road and it's changed. And so we're trying to be nimble enough to meet the needs and get those cases resolved. Yes, ma'am.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate everybody being here today. And again, members, I know time is short, but they'll be available after the meeting for any further questions. Next up, presenting on behalf of state attorneys and the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association is state attorney from the Second Judicial Circuit, Jack Campbell. Mr. Campbell, welcome.
Good morning.
And
how are you, sir?
Recognized.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Jack Campbell. I'm the state attorney here in Tallahassee. I'm also the vice president of the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association. So I'm speaking on behalf of all of your 20 elected state attorneys, and I'll be making our presentation today. First of all, I've prepared a PowerPoint for you that gives just basic coverage. I know that most of you are very, very familiar with the criminal justice system. Last year, we started talking, and I'm stealing a little bit from Judge Mahan. He talked about the snake. It's actually a hose. And we now have the pandemic. We are 50% more cases than pre-pandemic. That's where we are in criminal cases. So if you looked at our numbers statewide, and we're taking these from the state court administrators, 49% increase. We went from 51,273 felony cases to 76,215. Misdemeanor cases, 203,000 to 312,000, 54%. And we're doing this with less staff. The fact of the matter is there are less prosecutors in the state of Florida today than there was in 2017. And we're running into the same problem. We have 270 approximately assistant state attorney spots open right now. We have over 450 support services open right now. More work and less pay. We appreciate being held harmless last year. We appreciate what we've done, but the fact of the matter is the bill is now due, and I need prosecutors in those courtrooms. I support everything that the judge has said. I like the fact that they're doing a temporary. If I could just get the prosecutors on, fill my FTEs right now statewide, we could start making some hard decisions. Because the truth of the matter is, the cases, all the low-hanging fruit has already been plucked. We've been getting the same calls that I'm sure you're hearing from your sheriffs, which the people who are in custody have, please find a way, get a diversion, credit for time served, get these folks out as fast as I can. And so to give you an idea, once again, I'm here in Leon County. Of the 1,100 people in the Leon County Jail currently, I only have 100 who can be bonded out for any number. Some of those are hundreds of thousands of dollars. So everyone else is on a no-bond hold. That means that the cases that haven't been resolved during this pandemic are the most serious. These are the cases where serious prison is coming in, victims have been impacted, and we need our best and brightest. Unfortunately, once again, I have a critical staffing problem for those most serious of cases. We have to have experienced prosecutors who can come in and do that. Once again, you're going to start seeing, and it was just mentioned, we have great diversity. When you see our LBR request, there's just a different type of staffing. We really appreciate what you all have done for us over the last few years. The 50,000 starting was a big step in the right direction. Last year, you did a nice thing for our support staff, and we've stepped up with minimum wage. But what this results in for me as a supervisor and for all the rest of the state attorneys is I had to use all of my discretionary money to sit there and offset the compression that was created. So now what I told these prosecutors 3 years ago, yes, I know that you were just caught by somebody who started 2 weeks ago with salary. You've been here for 2 years starting at 38, and now you've made it up to 49. The brand new guy just caught you at 50, and now y'all are neck and neck. I need to try to offset those 5 to 7 years just like anybody else. I want to be able to have the discretion, and we need to be able to offset. Those were the people that are most critical. If you meet people in litigation, often they tell you they started as an assistant state attorney or as an assistant public defender. The problem is that I'm losing those people when they become the best at their trade, when they're getting to 5 years of thing. And once again, these cases that have been wading through this backlog that are now 3, 4, 5 years old, they need serious, experienced attorneys. When you're talking to a victim, I was telling somebody the other day, I have a law enforcement officer who was hit and run and killed here in South Leon County. His trial was set, or the trial of the person who killed him, was set the week before the pandemic shut it all down. His widow had to wait throughout the pandemic for that case. As soon as we got jurors in the building, as soon as a jury was sworn, he entered a plea straight up, and the case was resolved. But it took real people and real experienced prosecutors to try to move those, and that's what we've got to do. Another thing that's important to recognize is that your state attorneys actually handle every case in the criminal, including the ones that aren't actually numbers. There are lots of cases where law enforcement will contact us and say, this is the evidence I have, and we either say that it's insufficient to file charges, or we use a lot of the reforms that you've asked us to use, diversion programs, problem-solving courts. All of those are workload issues that may never turn into a case number because we are trying to. We have to work that, let alone the grand jury and some of the things. We come out and once again try to determine a forecast for this, and I wanted to just be able to explain to you where these numbers came from. If we were to stay at par, just offsetting the cost of living increase in the state of Florida and the population from last year to this, that would be a 3.34% budget increase. And that's what we're asking for, is a $13,238,133 increase. We're asking for that as a workload. What I need that to be is we each need that money so that, once again, we can individually distribute that to these attorneys so that we can fill those spots and we can give justice to these victims. We need to be able to retain our folks, and that's why we're seeing this as a workload issue, and that's where we're coming. In addition to that, across the board, 13, we are a single line, and we don't want to be separated amongst the 20. I'm standing here speaking for the folks from Miami, the Keys, Pensacola, and Tallahassee, and we'd like that appropriation that we will divide it and decide where to spend it. In addition, we have four circuits that this legislature added new judgeships for. There are going to be new criminal courts in the 7th, 13th, 14th, and the 20th. The fact of the matter is, court is more than a judge. Judge is important, but if you want somebody to actually be able to argue the case, we need to have a prosecutor every time. Each of these four circuits are going to have new judgeships in the next year. We're going to need new FTEs for those spots just to be able to have them adequately staffed. Once again, the support staff is going to need, you know, in my office, I have one legal assistant for every three prosecutors, to give you an idea. We need some support staff to be able to do it. But once again, right now we're to have 150%, 149% of felony, 150 overall, more work, and we have 270 spots. And to give you an idea, there are about 2,000 prosecutors in the state of Florida. So we are 10% critically understaffed, and that's what we're working on. And once again, we appreciate all the support, and that's where we're coming. I'll answer any questions now, or happy to come across and get into the numbers with you if you'd like to.
Any questions for members? Representative Benjamin, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you have 270, we have a need for 270 statewide in terms of prosecutors. So that's our demand. What does it look like with applicants? Are there applicants that are looking to fill those slots and we just don't have the money to pay for them?
You recognize?
Thank you, sir. Great question. That's what's really different this time. We're used to having a regular burn. I'm lucky that I'm here in Tallahassee, so I got FSU Law School that's spinning out, and that's where we get a lot of my folks. But what's different this time is that our applicant pool has actually dropped astronomically, where, once again, that 50, we're getting more, and it's not a trickle, but we're the real critical need. So the quick answer is, no, we don't have as many applicants as we used to. But even more problematic is, once again, usually my folks will, their life cycle will give them about 3 to 5 years, and people are going to offer them a tremendous, take my skills and run. Those guys, if you think about 3 years ago, you started me at 50. Then you gave a 3% across the board. Then you did the compression with the minimum wage last year. So those guys have now at 3 to 5 years that came in. I need to get them up. They're leaving me not necessarily. People who want to be prosecutors do it because they like the work. They do it for the right reasons. But they just want to be able to raise a family. They want to have children. They want to be able to buy a house after 5 years. And they're walking around with $200,000 in student loans. Those are why I'm asking for this under a workload, so I can try to hold on to these folks who are have the potential to be a career prosecutor who can handle these most serious of cases. You just don't want a five-year prosecutor handling a murder case. That's just, it's not going to be as good a product. I was doing them at 5 years, but I'm better now at 20. And I think that's what the product that the people of the state of Florida deserve. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Member Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. You kind of answered my question in your last comment, but my question was student loan forgiveness. We've got a program, but I think it could be a little more aggressive. I think it's 10 years now that somebody has to stay in the office. Would it help if we bumped that up to like 7? Or, you know, what's the answer, you know, to get people to want to stay in your office longer and have their debts paid so that they're interested in keeping that government job?
Well, it's kind of pardon me. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because if you slide that from, I'm terrified. I've got several people in my office who are at about 8 and 9, and I sit there and watch the clock, and because they may well hit the door as soon as that debt is set relieved. I've got to try to have the balance of once they get to the point that they, and the way I put it, country is gut hook them, once they believe in the work. Usually the people who are career prosecutors are doing it. They're doing child sexual abuse. They're doing homicide. They're doing the worst of the worst kind of cases. They do that because of it's a calling. I need them to do it long enough that they realize, once again, they can have a family. They can have a quality of life. The truth of the matter is what we're putting these people through, and I'm very proud of my folks, but they can only look at so much child pornography before they take that home. They can only talk to so many homicide families before they take that home. So that's the bubble I would love to see, and I won't talk bad of them. You guys can slide it down to pay off their debts at 7, that would be great. But once again, I'm going to still need the discretionary money to say, yeah, now your loans are forgiven. Will you please still stay with me? And so I can turn. I have 2 prosecutors out of 45 with more than 25 years of experience. 2.
You recognize?
Are there any additional enticements that, other than money, that anything else that we could think, sort of thinking outside the box, that we could keep people in service longer?
Recognize.
Thank you. It's a great idea, and candidly, that's what I think all 20 of us are trying to scope with. I was sitting with Dennis Ward, who's from the Keys. He has an unbelievable, trying to live in the Keys starting at 50, he has a challenge very different than what I have in Liberty County. We are all working, trying to find a better work-life balance. Candidly, these young lawyers have learned after the pandemic, remote working. A lot of us worked, and we are, just as the judges, working more on a case management system. But the truth of the matter is, and I know that you practice criminal law, there's same reason why y'all have me here live today. There's a certain intimacy. And when I'm talking to you about the most serious, important thing in your life, I need you to be in the room with them. So I'm trying to get every efficiency I can to make it more palatable to them, to give them a better work-life balance. But at the end of the day, as much as they love the work, they, once again, they leave me because I want to have a third child, Jack. I want to buy a house, Jack. It's not that I don't like what I do.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to y'all in the future. Good to see y'all. Take care.
Great. And you can be available after if there's any further questions.
Absolutely. And I'm 100 yards away throughout session. All you got to do is I'm the courthouse across the street. So thank you all very much.
All right. Okay. Next up, we'll presenting on behalf of the Public Defenders and the Florida Public Defender Association is the public defender from the 8th Judicial Circuit, Stacy Scott. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I can figure out how to X out of that. There we go. All right. Slideshow from the beginning. Okay. Good morning, members of the committee, and thank you so much for having us here, and thank you for everything you've done for the public defenders statewide over the last few years. We're grateful for the funding you've been able to provide to us. My name is Stacy Scott. I'm the public defender from the 8th Judicial Circuit, which is down in Gainesville, and I'm also the vice president of the Florida Public Defender Association. Here to talk about our budget priorities for this session. I'm just going to kind of blaze through part of this PowerPoint. As you all know, public defenders are on the front lines of justice. We are appointed to every single person who's facing a loss of liberty in a criminal case who cannot afford to hire an attorney. We're also appointed to as the front lines on all the Baker Act cases statewide, which have, as you know, have increased dramatically over the last few years. We perform core functions. We're really the other side of the coin of the state attorneys. We're equivalent to first responders and law enforcement officers in the sense that we're an equal partner in the justice system. You can't have one without us, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, anyway. Just quick statewide facts. Despite the COVID-19 shutdown of the courts, last fiscal year, we still took on 433,000 new cases. So that's not the cases we had when the whole pipeline stopped, and that's not the cases that attorneys carry forward from fiscal year to fiscal year. Those are just brand new cases. We're 20 independent offices with independent budgets and independent needs that vary wildly across the state. But we also have one common need, which is to recruit and retain quality attorneys. And we have one common crisis, and that's that we can't do that. We have a dramatic decrease in applicants and an incredible increase in our turnover statewide. We jumped to a 26% turnover rate for assistant public defenders in the last fiscal year. Some circuits had as much as a 50% turnover rate. In Tampa, in Tallahassee here, in Miami was pretty close to 40, and in Orlando was 50. Just under 50. So we're having a dramatic increase in our turnover, which slows the justice system down because you cannot put a brand new attorney on a serious felony case. It takes time to train them, and we just can't keep up with the turnover. I can hire all the brand new lawyers I want normally. Now I don't have any applicants, but normally I can hire all the baby lawyers, as I like to call them, that I want, but those lawyers are not equipped to handle serious felony cases, and that's where the bulk of the work is. So that leads me to our priority budget request for this year. We're asking for a competitive pay increase for assistant public defenders of at least $5,000 per attorney. I mean, that's a number that we thought was, you know, reasonably achievable, but in reality, it really needs to be higher than that. I think the Attorney General's budget request asked for $10,000 across the board per attorney. That would be wonderful. I know they need it, and we need it too, as do the state attorneys. So, but our ask is for $5,000. That's approximately $7.8 million in recurring general revenue that for all 20 circuits and all APD positions. Our second issue is for support staff salary compression that's created by raising the minimum wage. So we have a lot of support staff that now that the minimum wage has been raised up to $13 an hour, their salaries are now compressed, and they've been loyal and good employees for years, and we're asking for basically a $2,080 increase per FTE for non-attorney FTEs in our offices statewide, and that's about $2 million in general revenue. The justification for our budget request, you know, it's we're getting poached, right? We're getting poached by other government agencies. We're getting poached by civil law firms. The civil backlog that you're hearing the courts talk about affects us because these law firms are out hiring lawyers just so that they can push through their foreclosure cases and all their cases that they're trying to move to make money for themselves and get their clients' issues resolved. And where are they turning to find these attorneys? They're turning to brand new attorneys out of law school and offering more money than we can pay, and they're turning to our experienced lawyers in that 3 to 5 year range especially, and they're offering them raises that we can't match, and they're pulling them out of our offices and pulling them into the civil world. Our salaries, even though we're grateful for the $50,000 starting pay that we got a few years ago, It's still well below the national average for pay for assistant public defenders. It's still below what, way below what the federal public defender will pay a brand new attorney. They're starting at $65,000 a year for a wet behind the ears attorney right out of law school to go to the feds. So it's a crisis that's reached a critical boiling point for us. And you know, you cannot address this backlog with more judges. You can have all the senior judges you want, but you got to have assistant state attorneys and assistant public defenders in those courtrooms to try those cases. And the public defenders statewide are representing about 75% of all the cases that come through the criminal justice system, with the remaining percentage being private attorneys or the conflict counsel. So we're it. And if we don't have lawyers, we can't try those cases and get justice for our clients, and the victims can't get justice either. So we're asking you to consider that $5,000 per attorney increase. It's critical. We need it. I've been the elected public defender for 11 years. I have never had to place an ad to try to find an assistant public defender. In Gainesville, everybody wants to stay in Gainesville or live in Gainesville. I usually have a stack of applicants like that. I've had to place ads, and I haven't gotten any responses. So we're asking you to please consider our critical funding crisis this session. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mrs. Scott? Representative Rayner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And thank you so much for all that you do. As a former assistant public defender, I have a special spot in my heart for the work that y'all do. I just had a quick question. When you were talking about the national average with regard to starting salaries for assistant public defenders, what is do you know that number offhand, what the national salary is?
Yeah, and in my folder back there, I have a spreadsheet from a national law school placement survey that was done in 2018 that kind of showed where folks were at in public sector salaries and starting and at 5 years. And I want to say that the average nationwide starting was 58, and then it jumped up to about 65 or 66, and then it jumped further. So we were behind on all categories, in whether it was 0 to 5 or 5 to 10 of the national average.
Any other questions? Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer this or not, but there was a time that private attorneys were used to as conflict counsels for cases. They were appointed. And then we created the Office of Criminal Conflict and Civil Regional Council. And now I see that as a budget, as a budget item in our budget. Has it, and I believe that the thought was that it was going to decrease how much the state was spending with regards to these conflict councils. Has that been the case?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I believe it has been the case. We conflict out, our statewide conflict rate is about 6%. So only 6% of the cases, of all those cases we bring in, that we get out of. And that 6% goes to regional council. I do believe that there has been an efficiency of scale, just that, like, it's efficient for the public defenders to handle, you know, hundreds of thousands of cases. I think there has been some efficiency with that. There are still conflict attorneys who, when the regional council has a conflict, that then there are still private attorneys that are appointed to indigent cases. But I do believe that there has been some cost savings.
Okay. One more follow-up.
So is it, from the public defender standpoint and caseload standpoint, is there, can we go back to, can you ease that caseload by greater utilization of private attorneys?
Recognize.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The short answer is no, and I don't think that would be efficient. You know, I think that when a private attorney is appointed to handle a case through the conflict system, the average cost per case is incredibly much higher than the average cost per case when a public defender's office handles it. So, you know, us farming out cases to private attorneys, I don't have the budget to pay it out of my existing budget, and I don't think that that's the most efficient way to try to address the problem that we have. I think the most efficient way is for us to fill the FTEs that we have. Mr. Campbell referred to the state attorneys being down about 270 FTEs statewide. Well, we're down about 240 assistant public defender statewide of just our existing FTEs, and you know, we have half the budget, almost a little more than half the budget they do. And so we are down a significant percentage of our folks, and if we could just keep those vacancies filled, we can handle the caseload that we have, and we love the clients we represent and the work that we do, and we want to keep those clients because we know we give them the best representation possible at the best cost possible to taxpayers.
Okay, thank you. Next up, Representative Caruso, and then it'll be followed by Ranking Member Gottlieb, and I'd like to get this segment wrapped up in about 2 minutes. We've got four more agencies, and it's 11:51. We have to wrap up by 12:30, so let's please, if you could be as concise as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it real quick. You know, we heard from Mr. Campbell and with regards to state prosecutors and all these positions empty and the salary compression. Now we hear it from you. Is $5,000 really going to fix it? I mean, honestly, are you asking for enough?
You recognize?
No. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I wanted to answer that so bad.
That sounded like a short answer, no.
No, it's not enough. It's not enough, Representative. It's just we're trying to take small bites at the apple, but no, we think it should be more than that. The $10,000 figure asked for by the Attorney General's office in their budget request this year is more along the lines of probably what we really need to fix this problem.
Ranking Member Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. Sort of along the lines of what Rep. Benjamin was asking, I'm a criminal defense practitioner, was a public defender from 93 to 96. I see a lot of, and throughout the state, I see a lot of your 75% of those people in the system are not truly indigent. And I know that that's not the public defender's province to vet those, that's the clerks. Are the clerks doing, at least in my county, are the clerks doing the right job to ensure that the people you're representing are truly indigent, number one, and then number two, are those people paying the $50 application fee and you getting your portion of that to help fund the system?
You recognize? Sure.
Thank you. I think it probably varies pretty widely across the state in terms of what kind of vetting is done by the clerk's office. They're not really allowed to look behind the four corners of the document. They have to file an affidavit of indigency, which lists assets and debts and all that kind of stuff. And I my feeling is that it's probably pretty liberal in terms of appointing us, because if you think about it, like being able to afford to hire an attorney is not just about being just so poor that you don't have the money, but if you get charged with a serious felony and you make $30,000 a year and you have a state job with benefits at $30,000 a year, you're going to lose your job and you can't afford to pay a private lawyer $15,000 to represent you in that case. So there's kind of we get put in a tough bind in that situation because, you know, if we know a client has assets, then we encourage them that they ought to be hiring a private attorney. And we can ask to recover attorney's fees that are greater than the minimum statutory amount if we feel like clients have assets that are available for that. We have done that with cases we've had in the past where we had a local doctor was charged with attempted murder and, you know, didn't have the assets to hire a private lawyer, but had some assets. And so we were able to recover a greater amount in her case. But the $50 application fee, yeah, I mean, the collection rate is really different statewide. We would love to get more assistance from the clerks or the judges and encouraging people to pay that. In every letter we send to a client, we tell them that you're supposed to pay the $50 and you have to pay it within 7 days of your appointment. I track it. I track it in my case management system. But even if we collected 100% of that $50 that goes into our trust fund, it's still not enough to fund the issues that we're talking about. But yeah, we try to get that money, which feels awkward when you're representing indigent people and you're like, I need you to give me this money. But we have to do it, and that's the position that we're in.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for being here today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is the Criminal Conflict and Civil civil regional councils, which include Candace Brower, regional councilor from the 1st District, and Ita Namatin from the 2nd District. Before we get started, so we have four agencies left. If you run the math, that's about 8 minutes or so each. So for the presenters, try to keep maybe the first third of that for presentation and then the rest for questions. And if we all kind of stick to that, we can finish on time and under budget. So you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. It is an honor to be here and be here live in person. I am Candace Brower. I'm the regional council for the 1st region of Florida. And just to let you know, I started my career as a prosecutor, making a whopping $21,000 a year. And I stayed long enough to work my way up to career criminal prosecutor and left making $36,000 a year because I needed to pay my loans. And back then, there was no debt forgiveness. So clearly, that is something that I can vouch for has been an issue with prosecutors. But it's a wonderful place to start and learn how to become a trial attorney, which is what I did. And we were created in 2007. And Representative Benjamin, you were right to ask that question. We were created to save money and handle the cases that the public defender couldn't handle due to a conflict of interest. So we do handle all the same cases that the public defender handles, including death penalty and death penalty resentencing cases. But we are also created to handle any case, any civil case, to where you're entitled to a lawyer and can't afford one, such as in dependency cases that are the most common. So we are the first line of the defense for those, the public defender of sorts for those cases. But you might not have heard of all of the other cases that we are assigned to handle as the first line of defense, including guardianship, adult protective service, and tuberculosis cases. So there's many, many cases that used to all go to private attorneys first, and now they come to us first. And to date, the estimated savings to the state of Florida has been approximately $400 million. And we're very proud to keep being able to take these cases and keep being able to save the state money. But in order to do that, certainly we want we need to be able to be properly funded. So this is 2018 calendar year, pre-pandemic levels. Regional councils were, as a whole, were appointed about 61,000 cases statewide. It has not changed much post-pandemic as to how many we were appointed to, but we do have many more cases that are open due to the backlog and the halting of trials and things like that in both dependency and criminal. Less in dependency, they started very quickly going to remote proceedings in those. This pie chart shows 30% civil cases and about 70% criminal total, but that varies widely from region to region. There are five regions in Florida, and some regions have more civil cases than criminal. The first region has more criminal than civil, but we all have both criminal and civil attorneys. We have three main priorities for all five regional council, or for all the regional councils as a whole. And the first one is to close the salary cap gap, as I call it. So both the public defenders, state attorneys, regional councils all have a salary cap that is set in statute, which means we cannot pay our attorneys any more than what we make. The public defenders and state attorneys do make the same. And traditionally, we've been about 30% less than that from year to year. And certainly we understand that we are an agency created to save money, and it is a wide gap, but it's somewhat workable. So if somebody were to look at what the maximum amount any of them could make working for us, they would have to consider if they were an upper level attorney or death penalty attorney, they could make 30% less at our agency than they could at one of the other agencies. So last year, 10%. Raised to the salary caps of the public defenders and state attorneys were given, and they did not give that to the regional council, so it just widened the gap. So we're just asking to be able to keep up with the same gap rather than further getting apart from them and keep up with the historical disparity without worsening the problem. And that is would amount to a total request of about $80,000 statewide for all five regional councils. The second and probably one of the most important issues for the regional councils is retirement. When we were created, nobody earned the senior management service retirement. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that the legislature granted senior management service level retirement for the regional councils and the chiefs only. We did ask for it for everybody, because if you can go work at a public defender's office or a state attorney's office right out of law school and be earning a higher percentage in retirement than you could working for us. I made less in retirement than an assistant public defender when I was appointed by the governor in 2016. So it is just one of those disparities that we have to sort of give that disclaimer to when we have an attorney coming over from a public defender or state attorney and letting them know you're going to be earning less in retirement by coming to us. A lot of them didn't even know they were making it right out of law school. But for some people, it is a deal breaker. And so we're asking at least the upper level senior attorneys, the ones who supervise as the statute intended for positions policymaking or managerial in nature, be able to earn that retirement so other attorneys will have that upward mobility if they come to work for us. And that won't be a deal breaker for them. They could, you know, work their way up.
Could you try to wrap it up?
This is the last priority, and we are just asking that if any pay adjustments are made to the public defenders and state attorneys, that our attorneys also get the same, so we don't continue widening the gap for them and creating this competition between the offices, because we are a legislative success. Representative Benjamin, to answer your question, we're $400 million and counting, and we're not just criminal defense, but we also work in the dependency system, reunifying families. We want to continue to be able to do that.
Okay, next up, Eden Nabatin, and then we'll take questions. And Ms. Nabatin, I know you're here to talk about a new initiative. So try to keep a fairly short presentation, because questions on this could be many and probably we won't be able to handle them publicly, most of them, but you'll be available afterwards for questions.
Yes, sir. Okay. Absolutely.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm just going to jump right in while he's helping me with computer issues. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. My name is Eton Emotin, and I am the Regional Counsel for the 2nd District Court of Appeal. Thank you so much for allowing me to present today. My region is the 2nd District Court of Appeal. I am in charge of 14 counties and about 80 cities. I have close to 130 attorneys and staff that work for me. So I don't want to go over what Ms. Brower has talked about. I agree with what she says. Our priorities are mostly the same. I'm also asking for a backlog issue, swipe cards for my offices. But the major initiative that I would like to talk about today is something that I created. It's called the Cross-Jurisdictional Death Penalty Program. And this Cross-Jurisdictional Death Penalty Program is meant to increase diversity within death penalty litigation, increase the learning opportunities of students in colleges, as well as in law schools, and make sure that representation is not diminished in effectiveness, that it's good representation. And more importantly, this initiative will save millions of taxpayer dollars. So the way that I've created this is I have, in addition to my Juris Doctorate, I have an LLM in business law, and I am very passionate about business and law together. It's interesting that what Ms. Brower said is absolutely true. The regional councils do save a great amount of money, but where they can save the most is the death penalty realm, and that is why I concentrated on this program. I created this as a result of my second postgraduate degree, my master's in public administration. And the idea of this program is to qualify attorneys in-house. So currently, to become a death penalty qualified attorney, there are different steps that attorneys have to take to get there. So I'll give you an example. There are 107,000 attorneys in the state of Florida, and there are about 120 first-year qualified.
We're going to need to wrap up in about 1 minute.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but we've got three more agencies and questions. We'd like to take a few questions for you all.
Yes, sir. Basically, this builds death penalty qualified attorneys in-house and saves taxpayer dollars, and we are the best position to do this because I've been doing this for 10 years since I was appointed.
Well, great, and thanks. And of course, this is a complex issue, making a change like that. So I'd encourage any members to meet with Ms. Napleton afterwards or even in your offices to take a look at this new initiative. Okay, any questions for the conflict counsels? Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For conflict counsel, my question is, where do you get your talent and what's your turnover? What's your turnover?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question. We recruit, I assume by talent you mean attorneys. Okay, thank you. We recruit from different law schools. I taught as an adjunct professor voluntarily for about 8 years at Ave Maria School of Law. So we have a lot of interns that start from there. Then they pass the bar, they work with us. We have programs with, I believe, Stetson, Florida Gulf Coast University, and we like to recruit from universities. From colleges, because that is the way to, you know, like, for example, one of our students was a student in my class. I taught advanced criminal law and procedure at Ave Maria, and then he decided he liked it. He became an intern. Then he passed the bar, and he came to me, and he said, Ms. Nimon, I passed the bar. Will you hire me? This is before all the COVID issues, so back then I had lots of applications. And I said, yes, absolutely, because by that point, I already knew what he could do. So we have gotten a great deal of attorneys from law schools and colleges in this manner.
Well, thank you. We're going to have to keep on moving then. Thank you and Ms. Brower for being here today. And again, they'll be available afterwards. Next up, we're going to go to Capital Collateral Regional Councils. Neil Dupree from the Southern Region, you're recognized.
Why am I not escaping? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you have two big agencies after me, so I'll be brief if I can be. My name is Neil Dupree. I'm the Capital Collateral Regional Council for South Florida. There are three Capital Collateral Regional Councils, and I don't want anybody to be confused. There was some confusion yesterday in front of the Senate. Our office is not at all related to Ms. Nimoden and to Ms. Brower's office. Those are the Criminal Conflict and Regional Council. We are the Capital Collateral Regional Council office. Our offices deal with post-conviction death penalty work. We represent our clients from the time the case comes out of the Florida Supreme Court. If the death penalty is affirmed and the conviction and the death sentence is affirmed, our offices take these cases, and we have the case from the time that it comes out of the Florida Supreme Court until either we get relief for our clients or the sentence of execution is carried out. There are three regions. They're all based on the federal district courts, because our lawyers, as opposed to some of the other agencies, state attorneys, public defenders, regional conflict counsel, we have to have an expertise in both the state and federal courts because we carry our cases through the state and federal courts up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We have some of the same issues that the other agencies have talked about, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but I'm going to be. We are having the same difficulties the public defenders and state attorneys are having. We are having a difficult time hiring people. We have put out a national net. I can tell you the last two people that I hired, one was out of George Washington University, another one was out of Tennessee. So we're not just concentrating locally on law schools or in the state of Florida. We actually cast a wide net. I can tell you that the turnover rate for us is something I haven't seen in the 23 years I've been the head of this agency. We've had a 40% turnover rate. It's really been incredible the last couple of years. I can tell you that my region alone, I have a 43% turnover rate this calendar year. I've lost three lead attorneys who have 90 years worth of experience. I lost three other second chair attorneys to other agencies. And as an example, I will tell you that there was one of my lawyers who was going to be up next up for a lead position, left to go to the federal defender's office, and she got a $45,000 raise. We can't afford to pay somebody who used to make a $45,000 raise. We have two issues.
Can you maybe another minute or two? And I think we can.
That's fine.
I think we stipulate the turnover is bad in these other agencies.
That's fine. We're asking for $179,000 in pay equity. What we're looking for is $5,000 for every person that's got less than 3 years of experience in our office. We find that the 3 to 5 year lawyers where we have the difficulty, and because we have to deal with Rule 3.112K, which sets minimum standards for our lawyers. In order to keep the person for 5 years, we're looking for a $5,000 increase for those people to that 3 to 5 year region. We're also looking for some money in terms of IT. It's a very small request. All three regions combined is $79,000. And that's essentially what we're asking for, and I'll answer any questions if anybody's got
any. Any questions? Seeing no questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here. Okay, next we'll go to Statewide Guardian Ed Leadham. Is the interim director, Dennis Moore. You're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. Pleasure to talk to you today about the Guardian Ad Litem legislative budget request for this year. As you know, my name is Dennis Moore, interim director, as the chair has introduced me. Thank you so much. And as you know, in Florida, when children are abused, abandoned, or neglected, a court case is opened in Florida's dependency court. When that happens, the guardian ad litem is appointed, and it's our solemn duty to represent these children, and we are honored to do that. Under federal law, we're appointed to protect the rights of the children and advocate for whatever is in their best interest. Under Florida law, that appointment is supposed to happen as soon as possible. So a guardian ad litem is the type of representation for someone's legal interest when they lack the capacity to represent themselves, such as children or adults who have been determined to lack capacity. Research and evidence has shown that a multidisciplinary model of the type used by the Guardian Ad Litem program produces better outcomes for children in the child welfare system, such as getting children to permanency quicker and protecting their welfare. The incredible part about our program, of course, the volunteers can't say enough about that, but there are these community people that are put together with children to mentor them. They're their champions inside and outside of court. Go into those communities, meet with service providers, schools, doctors, so forth. But they do much more than that. They find out what the child wants. We incorporate that into our best interest recommendation. We can. I've done that myself. But if not, we have to report to the court exactly what the child's wishes are. So we have two issues this year. The first issue is to represent all the remaining children in the child welfare system today. Currently, we've stretched our resources that you have graciously given us to represent these children to 85% of the children that we are representing today. So that leaves us approximately 15% of them to represent. And I have to tell you just very quickly how wonderful it's been to work with this administration and the commitment of the First Family to the children in the state of Florida, specifically the ones in the child welfare system. So we've worked hand in hand with our partners at Department of Children and Families in order to work through the details in order to get the point to make this request and be included in their 4E plan, and that is what we're asking for. We can do all of this with access to federal funding through Title 4E of the Social Security Act. So our budget request here is simple. We simply need access to our trust account for spending authority for approximately $4.3 million. We'll need an additional 67.5 FTE in order to get that money to the ground. Our last budget request is a very important one for us. It's $60,000. We will need revenue for that. in order to have one person in each of our judicial circuits receive the state's terrific certified public management training. If we do that, we think we can better serve our volunteers. We think we can be more responsive to them. In short, just manage them better. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to conclude with that, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Any questions for members? Seeing no questions, we'll keep on moving then.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll be available anytime anyone has any questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Last up, presenting on behalf of the Justice Administration Commission is the Executive Director, Rip Colvin. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for having me today. It was a pleasure meeting with you in your district office after I got drowned coming up to see you a couple of weeks ago. So I'm Rip Colvin. I'm the executive director at JAC. I've been executive director for 11 years. Love what I do. We're a legislative entity, or legislatively created entity, and we administratively serve everybody that's been up here so far. I mean, we do the back office, the administrative work, so that they can focus on their most important thing, which is their clients. We also contract and pay for private court-appointed attorneys around the state. So we're the sole source contracting agent for private court-appointed attorneys. If you look at this pie, JAC, the total Justice Administration budget's about $1 billion. The state attorneys are about half, public defenders a little less than a quarter. JAC is that little tiny sliver up at the top, administratively serving the agencies of Justice Administration as well as contracting and paying for private court-appointed attorneys, 0.69%. Just a little sample of the transactions that we do, third largest bill-paying agency in the state in terms of volume. And we do all this and more with 88 staff. So our LBR issues, there's 7 that we have this year. We asked to be held harmless last year. That was our only thing that we asked for last year, and we appreciate the treatment that we got last year, which was being held harmless. But we have 7 issues. First is recruitment retention for JAC employees. That's primarily directed towards my mid-level and upper end of the office. We are way out of whack in terms of parity compared to other state agencies doing the same type or more complex work. So we're asking for some support there in GR. Florida Palm is the replacement to the legacy state accounting system that was known as SAMIS, and they rebranded it as FLAIR. This is a total rewrite, total moving to a different program. Florida Palm, we're asking for 4 staff, 2 in my IT department, and 2 accountants to help with this implementation so that the agencies that were before me are none the wiser in terms of what's going on. Their bills get paid and their people get paid, so that's a good thing. Third is the legal section workload. I'm asking for salaries and benefits to hire basically a deputy general counsel. It's for the tremendous amount of complex work that my office is handling, and we are continue to lean heavily on the legal section, and I don't want my general counsel to quit. So I'm looking for some additional money and a position to set that up. Executive section workload, primarily that would be assisting the 2 other staff in the executive office with legislative issues as well as other projects that we have going through the process. Next is a risk assessment, cybersecurity. It's a once every 3 years, take a look at how we're doing and go from there, make changes to our IT issues. 60,000 is what we're asking for there, and we got your support a few years ago, and this is super important. Next is internet bandwidth, 18,000. As we continue to utilize Zoom and Teams and GoTo, we need 18,000 to expand our bandwidth. We're really pegging out right now, so we need some additional support there. And then building rent of 21,000, we lease private space and we have an escalator. The total ask is just under $1 million. When you compare that million to the total of the funds administered, is 0.09% of the total budget of Justice Administration, and we're looking for your support. And I'll be happy to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Colvin? Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, Mr. Chair, this question is for any of them who can answer it. Why the disparity between the state attorney's budget and the public defender's budget? Why the great gap?
I think I know the answer. There's a lot more of the state attorneys than public defenders on its most basic level.
But why?
Just what he said. I mean, pretty much everybody else on the other side, we are the state. We represent the state in all trial courts. So whether it's death penalty, there's a state attorney. Whether it's regional counsel, the state attorney. Whether it's a private lawyer, there's a state attorney. So we play the entire other side of the net, whether it's public defender, conflict counsel, private counsel, or any other party, the state always has to be done. The second thing I would say for workload is there are a lot of cases that never go and get filed as charges, where we work with your local law enforcement either to decide that they shouldn't be charges, or we do things such as deciding grand juries and things like that that are other statutory responsibilities. So that's we have to represent on all situations. They do segments against us. That makes sense.
I remember a few years ago, I saw this, several years back, I saw that, and it makes sense because on the public defenders, there's private pay, and there's no private pay state attorney, so to speak. So there's another way to put it. So you recognize for another question?
Just have the public defender, looks like that representative wants to respond to.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your question. I would agree with what Mr. Campbell said, is that they do things that we don't do. However, historically, for whatever reason, we were always funded at 50 cents on the dollar for what the state attorney had, when the reality is that we're doing more like 75% of the work that they're doing, in our opinion. So there was a historical underfunding. I admit that they do stuff we don't do, and they have more FTE than we have, but there should not be that 50 cent on the dollar disparity that has been. And we have worked, and you all have helped to close that gap and to right that wrong, and we've worked very hard to get to where we are, but there's still a little bit of disparity.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, as I mentioned at the during the meeting, please, you know, some are still in the room, and reach out to anybody that we didn't have time to hear completely from today, and or staff or myself, if you need more information, please feel free to come see us. And that'll conclude our agenda today. Any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Davis moves to rise. Without objection, meeting's adjourned.